This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the cafe. Did you know that a big portion of people who listen to Joy at work, just like you? Right now, times are very tough financially, and without your support, Joy may not be around to help you through your workday. So tell your next door neighbour, your friends, and even your dad to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday 10 till 12.
You are on Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Now, I've got a quick question for listeners. Do you want us to be known as Sat Mag or Saturday Magazine? Okay, let us know. I'm Macca. I'm hosting this morning with Joe Ball. Joe is the CEO of Switchboard. Our next guest is Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. Good morning, Misha. How are you?
I'm good, Macca. How are you?
Pretty good. What do you prefer, Saturday Magazine or Sat Mag?
I'm sort of a bit old-fashioned and formal, so I prefer Saturday Magazine.
Okay.
I actually like ordinary words that say what they mean.
Okay. Oh, well, that's always helpful helpful as an editor. That's a good thing. What a couple of weeks it's been, Misha. There's a few issues we'd like to touch on. One is, I'll just read them off for the listeners, the cost of energy, the goings-on in the US Capitol, particularly the inquiry in Congress, the Secretary of Treasury's comments around taxes and expenditure, and, of course, a family returning to Biloela. Where shall we start? Where would you like to start?
Well, I think, I mean, probably the big one that's affecting everybody's lives at the moment is the energy crisis.
Yep.
Just in terms of the price spike. And there was a meeting of energy ministers this week that came up with an 11-point plan. And I guess, you know, given we're now not in an election phase anymore, presumably the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is not going to be asked to recite all 11 points. But if he were, it probably wouldn't matter that much because there's sort of really only three things that they're actually doing that are significant. The big problem we've got is that basically in Australia we export almost all of our gas. We haven't set up gas reserves like they did in Western Australia across most of the country. And because of the war in Ukraine, there's been a massive increase in the price of gas, as well as having a lot of coal-fired power plants that aren't running at capacity because they're currently in the process of being run down. And all of those things have led to a massive increase in overall the cost of energy. I think gas is about 80 times what it was, and overall energy is about 3 times what it was at the beginning of this year.
So we've seen a huge increase in the wholesale price. A lot of that has flown through to commercial users, less so to domestic users. When you have that sort of a price increase, we're not going to see a consumer price, an increase to the consumer of tens and tens times, are we? Which shows you that perhaps the energy companies, you know, have got more ability to absorb those costs than perhaps they're telling us.
There will be big increases in people's electricity bills. It's just that it takes time to flow through. And to some extent, there's a smoothing out. So obviously, the companies, you know, there's spikes, and then obviously the prices go down for periods of time, and the companies look at longer-term averages. So it's not going to be as volatile as the wholesale price. But definitely, you know, it's highly likely we're going to be seeing an impact on our energy bills, which is why it's so pressing for the government, for Energy Minister Chris Bowen to be, you know, be seen to be doing something about it, because we are in a period where inflation is running fairly high, cost of living pressures on families are very high, and energy prices are certainly going to be higher.
Well, they reflect into everything, don't they? Everything that we consume, everything that has to be transported. It's not just heating and cooking. So it is going to have a big impact, and I see this as probably the biggest early challenge for the government. Let's move on to the US Capitol. you know, the congressional inquiry that's been held into the January 6 riot, or the attempted coup, depending on what you want to call it. It hasn't, some of the footage is absolutely shocking, some that hasn't been seen before. Do you think, Misha, Americans are in the political divide, but do you think those who are Trump supporters, do you think they actually understand what happened and that they were conned? Do you think they actually get it, or are they just, you know, they drinking the Kool-Aid?
I don't think that the Republican Party currently is reality-based at all. So there's a set of ideas that are functioning within that party about the election, about January 6th, and about a whole range of other issues in politics that are almost impervious to facts. And so it's very, very good that these hearings are happening. The footage has been astonishing. Liz Cheney has been incredibly courageous. Mm. But don't forget, as a Republican who is deputy chair of the Congressional Committee leading these hearings, she has been effectively, as much as they possibly can, cast out by the Republican Party. They've punished her, they've removed her from positions of authority. You can't get anywhere in the Republican Party currently without the support of Donald Trump and without professing publicly and repeatedly your belief in the lie, like in the fantasy, that the election was stolen. So, I mean, there's still a long way to go. It's extraordinary that you can have something that is so clearly documented, where the evidence is so compelling, and yet have so many people who are unwilling to sort of, you know, turn their face to looking at that evidence.
Yeah, this is Joe. I think it's really interesting, though. I think a lot of people in Australia don't really look at American politics and they can't really understand it. And it's really a historical question of, you know, for example, the gun control, which is now also just raging. Like, lots of Australians look at it and just don't understand the ideology that people put forward, which is that people say we need guns to protect ourselves from guns. And that's just quite a foreign idea, but it is quite embedded in the American psyche about defending yourself through guns. Do you think that plays into the Capitol riot and how people feel it's sort of okay?
Oh, absolutely. There's a huge culture in the US sort of, for want of a better phrase, gun porn. And you'll see actually a lot of political candidates will in their campaign messages create images of them with their guns hunting, you know, with military grade rifles. And it's quite extraordinary. And it's really got a deep connection to ideas about sort of masculinity and a sense that a certain section of the community are under siege to some extent from you know, progressive politics, and there's a sense that the identity is defined by this freedom to bear arms, which has a huge constitutional basis.
Mm.
But it's sort of more than that. It's actually about the ideas that bind the Republicans together.
It's a totally alien concept about having a gun, but when you see some of the images of people have dozens and dozens and dozens of guns, You know, some parts of some cities in America are better armed than some countries. And parts of some countries, you just wonder what it is. And I still can't get my head around, Misha, you know, where, you know, these mass shootings take place and people are still standing up and saying, well, I have the right to bear arms. But I have the right to, you know, have, you know, machine guns and other weapons that, you know, are being used in war zones.
I think it's even more than that they don't even just say I have the right to, they say that I need it because of it.
Yeah.
It's like this flip of argument where they say, well, if a teacher had a gun in the classroom, like you hear people put this forward, if a teacher had a gun in the classroom, they would have been able to stop the shooting. So it's kind of like, it's a stitched up argument, if you like. They sort of go, they use what could clearly be a case for gun control and sort of flip it. And I think that's what we in Australia really struggle with.
It's really interesting. There's a former NRA sort of senior strategist who has written a book. I heard an interview with him quite recently talking about the NRA strategy, and it really changed, I think, more than a decade ago now, when they realised that they weren't really in the gun sale business. They were actually in the culture war business.
Yeah.
And he says that they actually decided that the guns were sort of totemic of a certain, you know, subcultural identity within the US, somebody that wanted to express themselves a certain way, and that there was no strategic advantage for them to ever give in on anything. So the idea of sort of reasonable gun regulation, where you might say, oh, we don't need 18-year-olds to have access to these incredibly powerful semi-automatic rifles. We might just change that age to 21, which is a sort of reform that you used to get from, say, a moderate, you know, Republican or you know, American politician. All that stuff became off the table. And their strategy of responding to gun violence and some of these major tragedies was very much became one of not being conciliatory, just it's sort of our way or the highway, because they recognised that any compromise was seen by their supporters as sort of forsaking their culture war identity.
You know what, Michelle, I'm keen for your opinion on this. It's not a left-right divide, I see, with the gun control, because, you know, I have a bit of a self-curated social media where I see lots of LGBTIQA plus people across, you know, I follow different people from America. And then I get a shock that I think, oh, people who are progressive on these things that voted for Biden, that were Obama supporters, and see, like, you know, people in our community holding guns.
Yeah, clutching their guns.
And you sort of feel, like, I wonder what you think about that. It isn't a left-right divide, is it? Or is it?
Well, it sort of isn't. It is and it isn't. So there is definitely, overall, a much more pro-gun culture in the US across the entire population. So, yes, you're more likely to find a progressive or a liberal or an LGBTQI person who is somebody who owns guns, who maybe hunts recreationally. That's true. But there is also an extent that the vanguard of this whole sort of pro-gun and also no regulation, this idea that any regulation, I mean, you know, in Texas you've got open carry, for example, any impediment at all on your right to bear arms is sort of unconstitutional. That's very much a culture war idea that really belongs to the right.
Mm.
So I think, you know, there are gun owners across the community. There are gun owners that would argue for reasonable regulation, background checks, you know, some basic sort of safeguards. But the really hardcore, you will not take my gun, I can do whatever I want when I want, you can't even stop like a 12-year-old having a gun, that sort of stuff is certainly part of the culture war from the hard right.
Yeah, I remember for me the clash was when being in California and they say you have to stow your guns in your checked luggage. You can't take them on the plane. And I remember thinking, that means that people are in the airport now with guns. And I was like, that was a really – and then going to an Airbnb and the sign on the Airbnb said, you know, like trespassers will be shot. And I had a little laugh and thought, oh, that's funny. And then I thought, no, that's a serious sign, and they've got the right to have that, you know, a gun. So it's not just a threat. But yeah, I think it is very important for people to understand the cultural differences and where it comes from, and the Civil War, right, as well, the very makeup of being American, and the need that, you know, the Civil War was fought in that way and remains unresolved.
It's still going, and I think, you know, the right to bear arms, you know, is in the Constitution, but that is there in the Constitution when there wasn't a national army. It was a citizen militia, and it was a country that was starting off, or, you know, that had been in a war of independence. And, you know, so there's a whole set of different reasons. I wanted to, if we can, just move quickly on because we're running out of time. Stephen Kennedy, the Treasury Secretary, he's basically said things that Treasury Secretaries normally don't say publicly, and that is that we have, if I can paraphrase, a tax and spend problem. We're spending more than we gain in tax. We either have to cut spending or increase tax effectively. That's what he's saying, isn't he?
Yes, and he sort of pitched it as an unplugged speech.
Yeah.
And to some extent this might be part of definitely Labor has said they want to have a more robust and independent public service. The Coalition's approach to the public service is very much, you know, you do what you're told and we don't want you to be seen and we don't want you to be heard. And Labor's sort of committed to trying to have a more robust and active public service. But also, I imagine that Labor would have known about these comments and would, to some extent, see them as useful and necessary because they are working on a budget for October and there are some things that need to be looked at. I mean, the spending promises are such that spending as a proportion of GDP is going to continue to be high over the coming years. There aren't the plans to raise tax revenue to pay for all this spending. So that's a problem that needs to be addressed. And Labor knows it's going to have to do some hard work addressing it. And it needs people to understand that that's coming, I think.
And the Treasury Secretary, as a matter of custom, would provide the Treasurer with a draft of his speech.
That's right. He definitely would have seen it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not like, oh, no, you can't say that. And it is the challenge, isn't it? I mean, if we spend more than we bring in, if, you know, there are arguments, well, if that debt is going to fund infrastructure, then perhaps that's a good idea and it can be paid off over time. But the reality is the gap is so large, putting aside the current deficit, the gap is so large between spending and revenue that it can't continue. There has to be some change. And
that's right. And they've also got some big expensive programs like the NDIS, aged care, that are going to cost real money.
A couple of submarines, you know.
Yeah, so unless they actually increase tax somehow, and they'll get some of it back through bracket creep if we do actually get some wages growth eventually. But basically, I mean, they're going to need to look at revenue. The OECD was recommending a review of GST, which would be very politically challenging for the government to do. But it is going to need to look at something on the revenue side.
Yeah. Thoughts, Joe? I mean, you don't... Do you spend more than you earn? Sometimes you probably do, but you make it up, don't you? You catch it up.
No, my dad was an accountant, and he used to say to me, I've never had a credit card. I'm just going to... Like, I'm 42 years old and I've never had a credit card.
Get a picture. They want the credit bureau.
So, I was always told you don't spend, you don't spend what you don't have. That was my dad's, that was his main accountancy.
We'll make you treasurer.
Which is, well, it's not the case for governments, is it? Like, we saw there is a need to take on debt at different times. That is important.
And that's absolutely right, actually. Yeah, in actual fact, the idea that you run a budget like an individual household budget is a total misnomer. It's really misleading because, in actual fact, it's good and prudent and sensible for governments to run, you know, certainly at a lot of phases in the economic cycle to run deficits. Hmm.
And that was COVID, right? That was a COVID.
That's right.
And if we needed to see that. We needed to see that the government took on the debt rather than the households took on the debt because of the interest rate.
Yeah, but these problems that we're talking about aren't really made by COVID specifically because we're talking about sort of more the longer-term spending setting once the temporary measures are sort of all off. But basically, I mean, for any government, it should run its budget and can run its budget with pretty consistent deficits because basically what happens when you run a deficit is you're spending on things like education and infrastructure that actually build capacity and help drive GDP. Yeah. So effectively over time you grow the pie, and if you grow the pie sufficiently, the value of that debt as a proportion of GDP doesn't get out of control. So deficits aren't necessarily bad. This whole idea of balanced budgets, which people were crazy about for years and years, most economists say it's actually not that important. However, there is a limit to that. I mean, you can't run really large deficits over the long term. And it's getting to the point now with Labor's promises where it's going to spend money, it's going to have to start to think about how it finds some money to fund some of it. And that's going to be politically difficult. So it's just something I think we've just got to look at coming down the track for this.
It is. We're out of time, Misha. Thanks for the chat this morning, and I'm sure it will get a lot of people thinking. Misha is the editor of The Conversation. Independent media, same as Joy, well worth a look, and support them the same as you support Joy. Thank you, Misha. Have a great long weekend.
Thanks, I will do. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.